And now it's my great honor to introduce to you Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is going to be speaking with us next. Dr. Khalidi is the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York. He is a public intellectual who has his background in community-based work and is the director of the Middle East Institute of Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and the editor of the scholarly Journal of Palestine Studies. Dr. Khalidi is past president of the Middle East Studies Association, was advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations from October 1991 until June 1993, and has published a number of books. Some of you may have seen him speak recently about his most recent book at the AMP convention. His book is called Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Rashid Khalidi.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's always a pleasure to be back in Chicago. It's always a pleasure to be in this building where I've spoken many times. It's a pleasure to see many friendly faces here. It's not a pleasure to be here in this cold, but I'm used to it, and having lived here for 16 years. And for those of you who are sports fans, probably not too many of you know this, but pitchers and catchers report to spring training next week, and so the winter's almost over, if you believe that sign of spring. I was asked not to speak about the topic that I would actually prefer to speak on, which is the situation in Palestine and American policy. I was asked to speak on a different topic. I was asked to speak on how Palestinian support work in this country has been developing. So that is actually what I'm going to do, since that's what Hatem and the organizers asked me to do. I'm not older than some of you, but I'm probably older than most of you, whatever it looks like. I've been doing some kind of work around Palestine since the 1960s. So for about five decades in this country, I've been following, watching, fighting, experiencing how hard it is to work around the issue of Palestine. I started doing that in high school in the mid-60s and in college in the late 60s. I left the United States for many years. I didn't come back until the 1980s. I was in Beirut. And when I came back in the 1980s, I have to say, looking back at the period of the 60s through the 1980s, not much had changed for the better in terms of the cause of Palestine in the United States. Much had changed in Palestine. Much had changed in the Palestinian national movement between the 60s and the 80s. But here in the United States, it was still an enormously difficult situation. It was an uphill struggle. The word Palestine, the term Palestinian, were basically taboo. You could say them, but you had a great deal of difficulty talking about the Palestine issue in the 1960s or in the 1980s. And that continued to be the case for a very long time. And looking back now on these decades in which I've been involved, I actually can't remember a situation when the situation for people in Palestine or for Palestinians in Lebanon and Syria was quite so bad. But I have to say, I also don't remember a situation when the impact of Palestinian solidarity work in this country was so great. There has been an enormous change since the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s in this country. There has been enormous change for the better. And I want to talk a little bit about that this evening. We know about the grim situation that our people face in Gaza, in Yarmouk, all over Syria, in refugee camps in Lebanon, in the West Bank, and in many other areas of the Shetet, of the Palestinian diaspora. I talked this is in some ways the worst situation, I would argue, that the Palestinian people have faced since the Nakba. It's a very difficult situation. That's not what I want to talk about tonight. I will mention one other thing, however, that the political situation that the Palestinian people faces is no better than the humanitarian situation or the situation on the ground. On the ground, settlement expansion continues. On the ground, the siege of Gaza continues. On the ground, people are being driven out of the homes that they were driven into after the Nakba in places like Yarmouk. Politically, I would argue things are just as bad. Palestinian people are divided physically and politically. Their leaderships, in my opinion, are as bad as they have ever been in our modern history, as weak, as poor, as bankrupt in their thinking. And we are facing what I would argue is a very potentially dangerous situation in the plan that it seems Secretary of State Kerry is pushing. This is a plan that is based on the Oslo Accords. And the Oslo Accords are not just an agreement that was signed in Washington in 1993 and the agreements that followed. If you go and look at the book that I wrote last year, Brokers of Deceit, you will see that the Oslo Accords are based on the ideas of Menachem Begin. It's not an American plan. It's not Rabin's plan. It's not Secretary Baker's plan. It's not Yasser Arafat's plan. The people who signed it are not the people who came up with the ideas that are the basis for the current situation. Oslo and the Palestinian Authority are the brainchild of Menachem Begin. His idea was not to liberate the Palestinian people. It was not to give them self-determination. It was not to give them an independent state. It was to maintain indefinite, permanent Israeli control over the occupied territories and the Palestinians, and to do it in a way which would give them what he called autonomy. That is the core of the Oslo Accords. And that is the foundation for what Secretary Kerry is trying to do. Every leak we have seen about the negotiations, I don't want to go into it any further, indicates that it doesn't differ fundamentally from the status quo. It will extend the status quo of Israeli control into the indefinite future. Such a foundation cannot lead to self-determination. Such a foundation cannot lead to the Palestinian people achieving liberation. It was always intended to do exactly the opposite, and that is what Secretary Kerry, in my view, is up to. But that's not what I was asked to talk about. That's what I would prefer to talk about. But that's not what I was asked to talk about. What I was asked to talk about is whether Palestinian solidarity work in this country in general, and specifically the efforts around the case of Rasmi Audi, our friend, our comrade, our sister, the person who, you know, has been doing essential work in this community for many, many years, about how these are part of our larger struggle, which I've just said is facing enormous difficulties in our country, in our homeland, and in the Middle East, but has actually, in my view, made enormous strides in this country. And the way to understand the positive impact of what has been going on in this country is to understand this struggle as one to define the Palestinian people's cause as we would define it, as the Palestinians would define it, rather than having our cause defined by others. If we define our cause, we are a people. If others define our cause, we are terrorists. If we define our cause, we have been suffering from British colonialism. We were the victims of the Nakba. Our people were then divided and ruled by others. And we've never been allowed to rule ourselves. We've never had independence, self-determination, unlike every other people in the Middle East, including the Israelis, the Turks, the Iranians, everybody else. The sole exception besides the Palestinians is, of course, the Kurds. So every other people in the Middle East had that right, enjoyed that, and did well or did not do well with that. If we define our cause, of course, that's how we would define it. But anyone who reads the New York Times, anyone who watches CNN, or heaven forbid, Fox News, knows that that's not how we are defined by others. We are defined by others in ways that are racist, in ways that are demeaning, in ways that are actually worse than that, that define us as people who are inherently evil, who kill simply for killing, who are driven by irrational impulses, and so on and so forth. These are essentially racist stereotypes. The struggle in this country is a struggle for us to tell our story. It's a struggle for us to define who we are. It's a struggle for us to define the terms of what's going on. Is it a struggle between two equal peoples, both of whom have rights, who are on a more or less a basis of equality? No, it's not. There's one people that has had a state for 65 years and has oppressed the other people, our people, ever since then. That's the only way it can be properly defined. That's not the way it's defined in the U.S. media. And my point is that for many decades, we have essentially been part of a narrative that was crafted by other people for their own purposes. Back when I started working in the 60s on this issue, when I was a teenager, when I first became politically conscious, and ever since then, we have been fighting on other people's terrain. We have been fighting a discursive battle, a battle to control what is said, discourse, which other people have defined. They have given the words, they have given the terms, they have described us. This is now beginning to change. It is beginning to change because of work. It's beginning to change because people are finally learning that you have to spend money to change these things. Because people are contributing to organizations that are actually effective about doing something about this. Because you do not change it by sitting in a coffee shop and complaining, the New York Times is against us, the media are biased, the Israel lobby this, and so on and so forth. That's not how it's going to change. That's not how AIPAC, that's not how the Israeli lobby developed its strength. It took them decades and decades and decades of hard work, contributions, a lot of persecution. It's hard for us to believe this as a community that sees itself as victims, and we are victims, of police surveillance. I live in New York City. The New York Police Department is proud of the way they surveil our community. They're proud of the way they plant informants in our community. The mayor, the former mayor, the police chief, the former police chief, boasted of how they surveil our community, how they keep us under watch. So we know how we're treated in this country. It's hard for us to believe, but a few decades ago, the Jewish community was the victim of enormous prejudice. You couldn't buy a home if you were Jewish in some neighborhoods. It's hard for us to believe that today. That is what the United States was like in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. It took a lot of hard work to turn that around until you had a situation where Steve Rosen, who was the legislative director of AIPAC, was asked by Jeffrey Goldberg, how strong is AIPAC? And he pulled out a napkin. This was a few years ago. And he said, see this napkin? Tomorrow morning I can get the signatures of 70 senators on this napkin. 70 senators is a veto-proof majority. If you can get 70 senators, you can override a presidential veto. I can do anything I want, was what Rosen was saying. It took decades of hard work to get there from where the Jewish community was in this country in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And the suggestion that I'm making to you, strange though it may seem, is that we are actually beginning to go down that road. In my view, the image of the Palestinians in this country has grown more and more positive over the last few decades. Now, part of this was the result of work that wasn't done by us here. Part of this is the result of the fact that the Palestinian people took their own fate into their own hands, rebuilt their national movement, refashioned their own image, and began a struggle for their own liberation 40, 30, 50, 20 years ago. Efforts were made by Palestinians, enormous sacrifices were made, dozens and dozens and dozens of leaders, hundreds and hundreds of cadres, thousands of innocent civilians died in a struggle to reestablish the Palestinian national movement, to show that the Palestinians were not just refugees, were not just victims, were more than that, that they had a cause. So that's the beginning of a redefinition of who the Palestinians were, and it had a positive impact in many parts of the world. Later on, the First Intifada, at the end of the 80s, fundamentally redefined for many Americans the nature of this struggle. They had seen the Arabs in this country as the victimizers and the Israelis as the victims. Israel was tiny and isolated and defending itself. The Arabs were an enormous, powerful force and were always engaged in aggression against Israel. That's the way the New York Times portrayed the conflict. Without fail, it was my miserable fate living in New York to read the New York Times every morning. That's what I read every morning. That's what American television showed. The Intifada proved that that was not the case. The First Intifada showed that the Palestinians were, in fact, the victims. It was the Palestinians with the stones, and it was the Israelis with the tanks. It was the Israelis breaking bones. The 1982 war, the siege of Beirut showed the same thing. It was not the Palestinians who were besieging Tel Aviv. It was not the Palestinians who were destroying buildings. There weren't 17,000 Israelis killed. There were 17,000 Palestinians and Lebanese killed in the 1982 war. And the American media began to pick up on this. There have been other way stations in this media transformation. And many of these changes were a result of Israeli atrocities, like the 82 war in Lebanon, like the 2006 attack on Lebanon, like the attack on Gaza in 2008 and 2009. But that's only part of the change. The most important part of the change, in my view, has been what people in this country have begun to do, especially in the last 10 or 15 or so years. Increasingly, in the United States, we are seeing changes in the discourse because people, especially young people, especially people on college campuses, especially people with media training, especially people who are political activists, especially people with legal training, especially professional people who are forming groups and who are fighting, whether on campuses, some of them are Palestinian, some of them are not. Some of them are Jewish, some of them are ordinary white American kids. I go to campuses all over the country. I speak 20 or 30 times a year. I speak at campuses all over this country, state universities, big schools, small schools. Almost every campus I have been to in the last 3 years, there is a chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine. In some of those campuses, there is not one Arab student. In some of those campuses, half the members of these groups are Jewish kids, or most of them are just ordinary white American kids. They're not Arab, they don't have any relation to this conflict. They're just kids who see that this is one of the most important struggles of the 21st century. They figured it out. They don't read the New York Times. God bless them. Alhamdulillah. There's a generation that knows that what's in the New York Times is lies. I lecture to classes bigger than this twice a week. I have a big Middle East history course. Most of these kids, when I start mentioning what's in the New York Times in the morning, and I've been teaching for 40 years. I know when people are listening, and I know when they know what I'm talking about. I say, this morning there was an item in the Times on so-and-so. I get maybe 5% of the heads go like this. They don't read the New York Times. But if I say, yesterday there was something on the Daily Show, half the class is laughing at the joke. Jon Stewart said, so half the class is laughing at the joke, or Colbert said such and such about the Israel because they watched it. They've already seen it. And what are they watching? They're watching something that says everything you see in the mainstream media is a lie. These are hypocrites. They're worthless. Don't believe a word they say. That's what the 200 kids in my class every Tuesday and Thursday morning are watching. They are not watching CNN. They know it's rubbish. It's useless. It's worthless. And it is kids like that. It's people in mosques, in synagogues, in churches, union leaders, people of that sort, who are beginning to figure out that you actually can speak out on this issue and you will not be immediately treated as if you're an anti-Semite, as if you're an enemy of the Jewish people. People are beginning to be willing to fight that fight. And between us, I mean, we know how hard it is. What's happened to Rasmi, the charges against Hatim, what happened to Mohamed Salah, show us that we're obviously in some ways the most victimized community in this country. But I promise you, if you are a member of a mainstream church, which has traditionally taken a position supportive of Israel, and you come out against that, that used to be a very difficult thing to do. It's a less difficult thing to do. If you're a member of a synagogue, and you come out in support of the Palestinians, that was an impossible thing to do 10 years ago. It's becoming more possible, and more possible. Even as within the Jewish community, the right wing, the people who want to keep the situation as it is, become more and more conservative, and use more and more things like censorship. I can talk about examples of this. What you have today is a plethora of new groups, like Students for Justice in Palestine, like many, many young student campus groups, Palestinian, Arab, Muslim, things like the BDS movement, things like Jewish Voices for Peace, which simply didn't exist 15 years ago. There was nothing like this 15 years ago. It simply didn't exist. And it's everywhere now. It's incredible. I went to an event at Loyola. I've spoken at Loyola maybe 5 times in the past 20 years, to an event organized by Students for Justice in Palestine. There were 100-something people there. These kids got out over 100 people on a freezing night at the end of the world, the Loyola campus up on Sheridan. And that's remarkable. These kids had a lot better things to do than come listen to me. But they wanted to. This is something that they considered important. And I think there are many, many signs of the fact that these efforts are actually bearing fruit, not just on campuses. Some of you followed what happened with the Super Bowl ad that Scarlett Johansson made for the Israeli company SodaStream. Now, when we first heard about this, everybody said, oh, you know, there'll be a campaign against it and not a damn thing is going to happen. By God, alhamdulillah, amazingly, there was an enormous fuss about the fact that this beautiful blonde actress was the spokesperson for a company operating on stolen land, in occupied territories, illegally, and she didn't know a damn thing about what she was doing. She was obviously very poorly advised or believes what she's doing. The storm was so great that she was forced to step down as a spokesperson for Oxfam. The company that she is the global ambassador for, instead of getting positive publicity, probably got the worst publicity it could ever have gotten. And the issue of Israeli occupation, the issue of the illegality of it, the issue of boycotting such things, became mainstream news. We won an enormous victory because of this. It was something unexpected, and it's an example of how things are beginning to change. Another example was when Mayor de Blasio, our newly elected mayor in New York City, who's apparently a progressive and a good person, secretly met with AIPAC in New York City and was recorded as saying something along the lines, defending you is part of my job description. I'll always be there for you. You can come and talk to me. New York City politician going to AIPAC. Routine, you would say. There was a stink. There was an enormous, enormous furor. And immediately, a group of people got together and signed a petition, which got a number of really, really famous and important iconic figures in the New York Jewish community to protest and say, AIPAC doesn't represent us. They don't represent Jews. They don't represent New York Jews. Who do you think you're talking to? You're talking to extreme right-wingers who are not representative of this community, and the signatories were some of the most important people in New York City. And that got into the papers in New York. So here too, this is not just something that's happening on these campuses or something that's happening because Oxfam took the right position. There is a shift in the discourse taking place. It used to be you could not even be critical of Israel. And nowadays people are taking the attacks that come with being critical of Israel and are not being phased and are continuing to do it. Let me talk about three other things that are indications of this change. When a couple of scholarly organizations took a position in support of an academic boycott of Israel, the Asian Studies Association and the American Studies Association, and these are major scholarly organizations grouping thousands and thousands of academics. And they said, we support the idea of boycotting Israel until Israel ceases its discrimination against Palestinians, ends its occupation, and allows justice for Palestinian refugees. They came under attack. And among the attacks have been efforts in various legislatures. The first of them was in New York State to pass a law cutting off funding to any group that advocates a boycott against Israel. The bill passed the New York State Senate 96-4. Almost no opposition. Nobody heard about it. And anybody who knew New York politics, anybody who knew that the Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, the second most powerful man in Albany and the state capital, was the supporter of the bill. He was the sponsor of the bill, assumed that the bill would pass the Assembly and would be signed by the governor. Then something wonderful happened. Suddenly the groups that I'm talking about began to mobilize. The legal groups, the student groups, the New York Jewish groups that are progressive and that are fighting on this issue, the BDS people. And there was a firestorm of opposition to this bill. I was talking to people who were in the office of the chairwoman of the Education Committee of the New York State Assembly the morning that this bill was supposed to come before committee. Goes to committee, it's passed through committee, it's supposed to go before the Assembly the same day, supposed to be passed, put in front of Governor Cuomo, sign it right now, end of discussion. These two people who were there said the secretaries were answering the phones, couldn't stop answering the phones. They said, what's been going on? They said, the phones are ringing off the hook. Thousands of people were calling in to oppose this law. The law was withdrawn. We won an unbelievable victory with this defeat of this law. Now, this is the beginning. It's not the end. They're going to come back in New York. A similar law has already been proposed in the U.S. Congress. Similar laws are being proposed in other state legislatures, in Pennsylvania, in Maryland. These laws are manifestly unconstitutional. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm told by my lawyer friends that these laws are manifestly unconstitutional. This is an opportunity to organize around free speech, which brings with us lots of people who don't care that much about Palestine, but they care about free speech. And that's what happened in New York State. The biggest opponent of this law was the New York State Teachers Union. And half the Democrats in the Assembly suddenly started shivering. I can't vote for this law. These are my biggest campaign donors. The teachers? I can't oppose the teachers. And the teachers did it not really only, I think, because they love Palestine. In fact, I don't think they necessarily love Palestine. They did it because this was a clear free speech issue. The Senate and the Assembly voting a law that would cut off funding, that's the state preventing speech. That's a violation of the First Amendment. The last two things I want to talk about, I've been told I have 5 minutes, I'll end very quickly, are what's happening with films in cinema and what's happening in the broader discourse. Last year, the Academy Awards nominated as one of the 5 best documentary films a Palestinian film called 5 Broken Cameras. It's a wonderful film. It didn't win. It was the best of the 5. There was also another very good Israeli film which also was nominated. The important thing is this is going to become a regular thing. This year, in the best foreign film category, an extraordinarily good film, Amar, by Hani Abu Asad, has been nominated. We are getting our story into the mainstream. What we see, the way we know this struggle has developed, is not just in our community now. It's in Hollywood. There are hundreds and thousands of screeners, DVDs, out there in the home of every single voting member of the Academy. And they're all being treated to Palestinians what really happens to Palestinians. This has never happened before. These people have been brainwashed by garbage like Exodus, the movie Exodus, for decades. They are now finally seeing Palestinian films made by Palestinians about what's really happening in Palestine. This is unprecedented. This has never happened before. I'll conclude with one last thing. An old friend of mine whose parents were colleagues of mine in Beirut now teaches at Berkeley. He's a linguist. And he's been doing a big data research. He goes to Google and looks at every single book ever published and does crushes metadata. And he says, you can see from the metadata every book ever published in English, everything that every time the word Israel is used, every time the word Palestine is going up, 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 up. When I say the discourse is changing, this is not just an impression. The number crunching of the data shows that actually our narrative is really getting through. The word Nakba is being used more and more and more in English. What does that mean? If they even know what the word means, they know what happened. It's an enormously important beginning. Let me conclude by saying that this issue, Rasmiya's case, is important because it's part of the struggle over defining our own narrative. If the Palestine issue, if Palestine is about dispossession, if it's about occupation, if it's about torture to which she was subjected, if it is about the right of any people to resist what has happened to our people within legitimate legal means to resist that, then our narrative is the one that prevails. If the other side prevails and our narrative is not the one that's there, if the story that's told is a story about terrorism, then once again, it's the victimizer who defines the terms, and we are right back where the victimizer wants us. This is why mobilization around Rasmiya's case and others like this is absolutely essential. This is not just a court case. This is part of a struggle to determine how the story is told. It is not a story of terrorism. It is a story of people who have suffered and who are fighting against that oppression. And that is why it is absolutely essential for us to support Rasmiya, for you to be enormously generous, and somebody who's much better at asking you to be generous is about to come up here and ask you to be very, very generous, Rafiq Jaber. Thank you very, very much.